bill that there was one more speech. One of
I suppose that anyone that doesn't keep the program on time is that he doesn't get to speak. And but I do want to say a few things to wind things up. And I told Charlie Wiley, I understand I was out of the room, but I understand that Peter was rather severe with Charlie and cut him off before he got a chance this morning to make his the main points that he wanted to make. Where is Charlie? Is he here? There he is. I promised Charlie that I would give him an opportunity to make a couple of points. And Charlie, if you want to do that now, it's yours again.
I'd just like to make a very brief one, which I was going to end up with this morning, and I thought it was worth mentioning. We won the battle at Tet, which is the part of the program that I was commenting on this morning. I could go on at great length to tell you exactly why, and I could give you the statistics. I could give you a lot of facts. But take my word for it, we won. I think that's been backed up very strongly by other speakers. We won a lot more than the battle at Tet. The United States Armed Forces won every battle that they were in Vietnam. We never lost a battle in Vietnam. And when the United States of America left Vietnam after having broken the VC at the Battle of Tet, after having helped the Arvin and the Vietnamese Armed Forces break the all-out offensive of the North Vietnamese in 1972, we left Vietnam having won the war. I get so damn sick of hearing about how we lost the war in Vietnam. We didn't lose the war in Vietnam, despite the atrocious handling of the war by our political leaders, despite all of the harm that was done by the media, despite all of the mistakes that were made by the military, and there were many, despite the anti-war movement, despite all of the problems, we left ahead. We had kept South Vietnam free. We turned the country over. They did most of the fighting themselves during the Big Easter Offensive in 72. And they stayed free for 2 years after that. And they only went down when they were legislated down the river. The Congress of the United States voted to tie the hands of our president. They forbid him legally to give one bit of direct American support to our allies. They cut back the aid to the point that it was beyond belief, and they legislated the annexation of Southeast Asia into the Communist Empire. And I would just like to say that, in conclusion, that what we did in effect is mind-boggling. We had fought a long, long war, and it was like a showdown poker hand, and the table was piled with chips. Blue for the billions of dollars that we spent. Red for the blood of 50,000 American dead. And the other side threw a white chip out on the table. And the Congress of the United States said, we won't call. And they folded their cards and they turned the pot over to the other guy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie. Charlie Hubbs has asked me to add one thing that he left out of his remarks, and that was that when you talk, many of the reporters talk to vets, and they've been interviewed on television about Agent Orange, and they thought they got sprayed with Agent Orange. What they were doing was spraying malathion, an insecticide, which was used to kill the flies and other insects around the bases on a weekly basis. And Charlie told me a long time ago, he said, if you come across a vet who claims he was sprayed with Agent Orange, as he's done many times, you ask a question. Was it a camouflage? Was the plane painted in camouflage colors, or was it a silver bird? And I don't know, what is it, Charlie? 9 out of 10 times, they'll tell you it's a silver bird. That was the Malathion. And that's done all over the world at U.S. bases. So that is one of the reasons for the tremendous number of GIs who say that they got sprayed with Agent Orange. They were sprayed with Malathion, which is the insecticide that was sprayed out in California to kill the med fruit flies. Is that all okay, Charlie? Does that do it? I guess, ladies and gentlemen, that I don't know of any case in history, our history, recent history, where a television program or series has undergone the kind of scrutiny that this PBS series has undergone in the last 2 days. I think we've looked at it carefully, thoroughly, responsibly, and I think it's come out wanting. The mess of the problem is, are we going to be able to get this message across to more than the 150 people or so that have attended these sessions? And that is obviously what we must do. And that's what we are going to try to do by breaking into television. It's going to be tough. People have said, is PBS guaranteed that they're going to show your program? No, they haven't. They have said that they would look at it. And if we do a good job, they will consider putting it on. Now, they're not going to be happy about putting it on. They're going to look at it very carefully, and they're going to try to find, I'm sure, every possible reason to turn us down and say they won't do it. This is where we're going to need the help of all the good members of AIM in two ways, as I've said before, and I'll say it again. We need the dough to do this thing right. And, you know, it's possible. I've taken this responsibility on and said we're going to do it, and I hope I don't bankrupt AIM and have to close the doors because we don't get enough money to do it, as that would be a tragedy. So we need your help in that respect. Not only yours, but if you have friends and others, spread the word and get us the support that we need so that we can do a good job, so they will have no possible reason for saying you didn't do a good, solid, professional job and therefore we're not going to put it on. Now, the other thing that we're going to have to do is lean on PBS. Now, we have already written letters to all of the PBS stations telling them what we're planning to do, asking them if they will consider putting on this program. We have commitments from some of them to do it, not very many, some down in Texas mainly. And these were the ones, let me give credit to someone who hasn't had credit before, and that is the Vietnamese community in Houston, Texas, who demonstrated in front of the PBS station down there and found a sympathetic manager, Mr. Bauer, who came out and agreed that he would give time for a rebuttal. And that's how this whole thing came about, is because they got in touch with AIM and asked us to perhaps help them do something, and it was my advice that they not do what they originally planned to do, which was to put on, get some Vietnamese together, and then they'd get Richard Ellison and Stanley Carnot down, and they would have a debate on the air. I just didn't feel able and knowledgeable and as dedicated as they are, and I hadn't met any of them personally. I didn't feel that this was going to be a fair debate to put on these pros from PBS and Stanley Carnot against some intelligent, highly motivated Vietnamese whose English might not be of the best and who might not have, while they had knowledge of certainly of the history of Vietnam and so on, it would not encompass all of the criticisms, the kinds of criticisms that we've had at this program today. So we urged them to wait. We would try to put on a program that would be suitable not only for Houston, that would be suitable for the entire country. And that is what we're trying to do. Now, they showed down in Houston that by demonstrating, by speaking up, they could have make an impact. You can make an impact, too. You can make an impact by writing to PBS. And we'll give you the signal, and we'll give you the address. They've got a new president, Bruce Christensen. He's already on record as saying that they will put this on. He thinks they might well put it on hard feed, which means that every station more or less has an obligation to carry it, or it's in the schedule, or they'll put it on soft feed, which means the stations themselves can decide whether or not they want to carry it. And I hope that every one of you, if you are motivated by what you've heard today, will come out and say, yeah, we'll write a letter to Bruce Christensen at PBS, I think that's 475 L'Enfant Plaza, and urge him to do, we want it to be on hard feed. We want all the stations to carry it that are seeing the other thing. Now, I was going to, I had some prepared remarks. We are running late. But if I don't say everything here that I wanted to say in terms of my criticism of the program, there are a lot of things, errors that I know exist in the program that I think have not been mentioned, have not been brought out, and I would like to request the privilege to revise and extend my remarks, as they say on the Hill, and if we do put out a book, and I think we will, I've heard suggestions in the conference that would be very desirable to transcribe the proceedings here and issue them in printed form so that they can be distributed and read and studied. And if we do put that out, I would like to, what I say in my contribution to that book is not exactly what I'm saying here today, please don't write in and accuse us of inaccuracy, because I want to get you out of here before too much longer. I was going to talk about the media's overall role. We have known for a long time that the media are aware of their power. You know, it is my thesis, and those of you who have read the AIM report that we did, the flawed history of Vietnam, which we printed earlier this year, know that we pointed out in there that to a large extent the media were responsible for getting us involved with our ground troops on a large-scale basis in Vietnam back under President Johnson, and they were also involved in a very major way in getting the Congress to do what has been so amply described in this series of programs, to pull the plug and send the whole thing down the drain in a very disgraceful and disastrous way. For those of you who may not have read that report, let me just mention very briefly why I say they were involved in getting us. And this comes out again in the PBS series, because they do the same thing all over again. I don't think this has been mentioned. I haven't attended every session, because I've sometimes had to do other things, but the involvement, that Johnson's moving in those 500,000 troops came about, I believe, and some of those who have spoken at this program have indicated, because of the disorganization, the disarray that came about in Vietnam after the assassination of Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963. Why did we pull the rug out from under Diem? Well, Diem was stubborn, and he was autocratic. The portrayal of him in the PBS series is false, it's misleading. He was a great nationalist, he was a great hero, he was admired by the Vietnamese people. His style of ruling was not that of Lyndon Johnson, or the glad-slapping, glad-handing politician. But to everyone's amazement, he pulled the country together. He defeated powerful enemies, the Hua Hao and the Cao Dai. He organized the government, and he brought about order in Vietnam. He made South Vietnam a viable state. And as I mentioned the other day, they had a plebiscite between him and Bao Dai, and he took 98% of the votes. Now, they say that was rigged, and I'm sure that the Diem government took advantage of its privileges to skew the results in its favor, but it was not as badly rigged as Stanley Carnot has made out in his book, and I won't go into that right now. The ambassador to Vietnam, Frederick Nolding, General Harkins, the head of the MAG group, were staunch supporters of Diem. He had his enemies in the U.S. government. Some of the military officers were determined to bring him down, some of the younger officers, Paul Vann, Roger Hilsman, Averill Harriman here in Washington, were persuaded that Diem ought to go. But he had powerful supporters in the ambassador and the head of the MAG group, General Harkins. What was decisive, and I'm going to quote Pierre Salinger, he put the blame on the reporters, on the press in Saigon, for turning the tide, for turning public opinion in this country against Diem in such a way that Jack Kennedy was influenced to give the signal to those who were opposed to Diem to overthrow him. And here's what Pierre Salinger, John F. Kennedy's press secretary, said on the Today Show on September 13, 1966, 3 years after Diem's assassination. He said, "I think insofar as their dedication to bringing down the Diem government, which they announced to one and all in Saigon as one of the aims of the stories they were writing, they went beyond the guidelines of journalistic reporting. I think a reporter should report events and not try to create them. And I think that in this particular case, Mr. David Halberstam, you know that name, New York Times, Mr. Neil Sheehan, United Press International, and Mr. Malcolm Brown, Associated Press, determined that one of the objectives of their reporting should be to bring down the Diem government. How did they do it? By writing stories promoting the idea that Diem was persecuting the Buddhists. And that came through loud and clear once again in the PBS series. It was the persecution of the Buddhists, the immolation of the monks. And David Halberstam later on denied that he had reported that this was religious persecution. He said that he acknowledged that the Buddhist activities were political and the actions that Diem had taken against them were for political reasons. Not so. I've personally gone back and looked over his reporting, and he gave the other impression. What did they achieve by this? They achieved by this antagonism, criticism, demands, demonstrations even around the world for the removal of Ngo-Dinh Diem. Not just in the United States, in Europe, all over the world. This is the tremendous, we see here, the tremendous power of the propaganda machine. And there is only one propaganda machine in the world that's got that much power, and it's directed out of Moscow. Only one that I know of. We in the United States don't have that kind of propaganda machine. We cannot stimulate demonstrations all over the world by the Voice of America or USIA or whatever it is. And that's what happened. And President Kennedy himself was persuaded, against the advice of the ambassador and of his top military man in Saigon, to sanction the coup that killed a very noble, a great Vietnamese hero and resulted in his death. And it's one of the things that we have to feel ashamed for, but we suffered retribution for it because the people who were promoting it, David Halberstam, etc., were not anxious to see the communists win, nor the young military officers who urged them to write these kinds of stories, if indeed they did. They thought that Diem was an obstacle to the successful prosecution of the war. They thought that by getting rid of Diem, they were going to improve the situation. You see, Walter Cronkite and others have said that the reporters aren't liberal. They just are people who want to do good in the world. They wanted to do good. They wanted to improve the situation. They wanted to bring about change. But they were young men, immature men, not very wise in their vision. And they didn't do good because there was no one after Diem who could do what he was doing, namely hold the country together. It went into a period of chaos. They went through several governments in the next 18 months. The communists took full advantage of that situation, stepped up their infiltration, and it was that disorganization, the increase in North Vietnamese activity, that forced Lyndon Johnson to send in the troops on the scale that he did. So, we can thank our media for having brought about the introduction of our ground troops on a massive scale in Vietnam, which was, as Bernie Yeo said the other day, a major mistake. What about getting us out? Well, I think Charlie has covered this in part. We said that certainly very clear now that Tet was not the defeat that it was portrayed on television in the newspapers by our correspondents. I'm not going to go into all of the stories that I could tell. Walter Cronkite was one of those who went out to Vietnam in February 1968, was briefed, who knew what had gone on. He knew that we had won, must have known because of his briefings, that we had won an enormous victory, that we had clobbered the Viet Cong, decimated them literally. And yet he came back and put on a special program in which he said, in effect, that this was a defeat for our side. And that was a very significant factor in Lyndon Johnson's loss of heart. He said, he's quoted as having said, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, then I've lost the American people. The Peter Rollins film, which we are going to edit down to a one-hour presentation, is a very excellent analysis of the effect of the reporting of Tet, of Khe Sanh, not simply on the American people, but very specifically on the people surrounding Lyndon Johnson, Harry McPherson, one of his speechwriters, Clark Clifford, and others, who were instrumental in turning Johnson around and persuading him when he was still, he wanted to fight back, he wanted to carry the battle forward. These men who were his close advisors, who were respected, were instrumental in getting him to bow out. I mean, they didn't want him to bow out, but Johnson was beset. He was beset, I'm sure, by his own, what he had committed himself to do and what these close advisors were telling him that he had to do, and that is bug out. Out of Vietnam, the result was he bugged out of the race for the presidency. Now, am I wrong in saying that the media were responsible? James Scotty Reston, a respected New York Times columnist, he went on to become the executive editor, wrote a column in April 30th, 1975, it was published, and he said, Maybe historians will agree that the reporters and the cameras were decisive in the end. They brought the issue of the war to the people before the Congress and the courts and forced the withdrawal of American power from Vietnam. James Reston, not Reed Irvine, one of the most respected journalists in the country, April 30th, 1975. I don't know that he would want that statement repeated today. I'm not sure. I haven't asked him. Maybe I should. But he was proud of it then. He was boasting that this is what they had accomplished. They're not boasting much anymore after they've seen what has happened. They don't like to admit it. Now, was it a good thing or was it a bad thing that they did? Let's take a look at Philip Knightley. Where's my Philip Knightley card? Philip Knightley is a British journalist. He wrote a book called The First Casualty, which the point of which is that truth is always the first casualty of war. At a conference out at the University of Southern California, March 10th, 1983, a year and a half ago, Mr. Knightley said this. He said, as for the effects of these stories, he's talking about the reporting from Vietnam, I myself am undecided. You can accept one of two versions. The first is that the reporting toppled the president, destroyed a major American policy, lost the war, tilted the global balance of power, and is directly responsible for the sad state of Southeast Asia today. That's one version. But get this. If that is true, then I'm afraid so be it. Either one believes in a free press or one does not. If you tinker with the concept, if you try to achieve a three-quarters free press or a half-free press, then you risk destroying it because governments will always find a reason why on just this one occasion the press should surrender some of its freedom to the national interest. Quite an admission. We just may have caused one of the most horrible tragedies in recent history. History of the century, the Holocaust, the disaster of the boat people, the Cambodian genocide, the yellow rain, and all the rest. And Mr. Knightley says, so be it. If we did it, so be it. That's not too big a price to pay for us, for the reporters, to have the right to go around the world and achieve these noble results. Remember in the film that Peter Rollins was showing of Mr. Northshield, saying Shad Northshield, then of CBS, now of NBC, executive producer, one of the top people, said when when they showed the picture of the General Lone shooting the VC, and he said he didn't even think about what the consequences of that might be on public opinion. It was not his duty to think of the consequences. So that's what Mr. Knightley is saying. It's not our duty to think of any of these consequences. So we do bring about 2 million lives being snuffed out. So what? Let's do it. I mean, that's not our responsibility. That's somebody else's responsibility. But, you know, I can't help but forget that when Geraldo Rivera of ABC was covering the Panama Canal treaties. You know, the treaties were up for ratification back in 1978, and Geraldo was down with an ABC camera crew in Panama, and he was arrested by Torrijos's ununiformed police, and he and his camera crew were roughed up, and he said that he did not report this fully on ABC, on the news, because he was interested. He didn't want to do anything that might interfere, might block, might reduce the chances of the Panama Canal treaties being ratified. He was thinking of the consequences. And he thought that if he said that Torrijos's goons had roughed him up, it might tip that close vote that was in the Senate. And what is more, he said he had dinner that night with the reporters for the Washington Post and the New York Times, and they all agreed that that was the proper way to handle it. So they don't think of the consequences? Believe me, they do think of the consequences. They think of the consequences when it is in their interest. It is some cause that they are promoted, that they are committed to. They think of the consequences. And that is one reason why this conference is not being covered by the press. They are thinking of the consequences. And they don't want the stories that we've been telling here today to get the kind of publicity that they should get, they should be getting. That is why, when the National Endowment for the Humanities grant of $30,000 to AIM was announced, there was a certain amount of criticism that came through to the National Endowment for the Humanities for making a grant of this nature to an organization like AIM. Bill Bennett, the head of the endowment, told me that one of the reporters who called him said, "But don't you know that they are a conservative group?" Ron Powers on CBS, was incensed about this grant. He thought it was terrible. He thought that this might spell the end of documentaries on television. Imagine letting somebody go on the air and criticize a television documentary. And to show you what a disaster this would be, he cited the example of a television documentary called Nicaragua from the Ashes, which had also been financed by the National Endowment for the Humanities, and he was actually showing, again, while he was talking, he was over-voicing scenes from this documentary. Now, those of you who are readers and remember what is read in the AIM report may remember that we said that this was Nicaraguan Sandinista communist propaganda, and indeed, Bill Bennett, the head of the National Endowment, as himself said that this was an example of nothing more than socialist realism propaganda. Now, he was not responsible. It was his predecessor that had been responsible for making that grant, not Bill Bennett. But Bill Bennett has indicated that he doesn't think the National Endowment ought to be financing communist propaganda documentaries. Now, what do you think? I happen to agree with that. And I hope that the American people will agree with that. But Ron Powers, who is doing media criticism on the CBS Morning News, he thinks that's terrible, that the taxpayers' money should be denied to people who are putting out communist propaganda on the air. Now, there is another view from Philip Knightley's. We had a conference a few years ago, and we had an excellent speech from a German journalist who had covered Vietnam, Uwe Siemennetto. And Mr. Siemennetto said this. He said, "The tragic fate of the people of Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos is related to the fact that I and others in my trade have not done our job properly. Our intentions were not dishonorable, but we fail to realize that during the Vietnam era, journalism has entered a totally new phase in which some of the most essential ground rules of our trade changed profoundly. I am convinced that if we remain oblivious to this change, our civilization will suffer catastrophic consequences." Uwe Siemennetto was the editor of the Social Democrat newspaper in Hamburg. A very distinguished, not a conservative, not a right-winger, not a Nazi, a social democrat. He is a man who has the sense to recognize that producing a Cambodian Holocaust, to produce the Vietnamese boat people, to produce the tragedy of these countries, to do the same thing in Central America, is not something that the journalists, not something that any of us can shrug our shoulders about and say, well, gee, that's too bad. We're sorry it happened. But that's the way the cookie crumbles, folks. Indeed, the consequences for civilization have already been catastrophic because there is a civilization in Vietnam. There was a civilization in Cambodia. They were civilizations older than our own. And indeed, they have been destroyed. The results have indeed already been catastrophic. The only question is, ladies and gentlemen, will they be catastrophic not just for the people of Asia? And I will go to China, which 40 years ago went through this process, 35 to 40 years ago, went through this process again, and the journalists contributed there also to the destruction of that civilization. The only question, ladies and gentlemen, is, are we going to let it happen to European civilization, Western European civilization, and to the American civilization? And we are already seeing the threat to our civilization lapping at our very shores, 90 miles away in Cuba, a few hours flight in Nicaragua and El Salvador, and we are seeing exactly the same kind of operation going on down in Central America today as we saw a decade ago in Vietnam. And we are seeing the same idiots, the same useful idiots in the media, on Capitol Hill, in the universities and the colleges, sealing our doom. And I say that soberly. They're sealing our doom by obfuscating, by confusing the American people, by trying to tell them that we have nothing to worry about, just as they tried to tell us that the Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front, that these were indigenous, homegrown Democrats, pluralists, people who are going to, you know, they weren't going to become part of North Vietnam. There was nothing determined about whether or not this country, they would be communist and so on. As they had told us earlier that Ho Chi Minh, you know, he could be a Titoist. Now they're telling us that even now when we've seen all the evidence that Nicaragua is a communist totalitarian government, they're still trying to tell us that that isn't true. They're trying to tell us that the guerrillas in El Salvador, that these are pluralists. I mean, how dumb can you get? Is it dumb? I mean, can these people who have the ability to write and to read, can they really be that dumb? Well, Andrei Sakharov, the great Andrei Sakharov, who is perhaps dying in his exile in Gorky. We don't know what's happened to him. He has explained it in his famous letter. We've tried to make it famous. It hasn't gotten the attention except for Arno de Borgrav and Accuracy in Media and a few others. It was published in the New York Times in 1980. He smuggled it out. And he said, the West and developing countries are filled with citizens who, by reason of their positions, are able to promote Soviet influence and expansionist goals. He classified them into four groups. One, those motivated by ideas. Two, those who act in a progressive manner because they consider it profitable, prestigious, or fashionable. And three, those who are naive or poorly informed, who close their eyes and ears to the bitter truth and swallow any sweet lie. And finally, people who have been bought in the most direct sense of the word, not always with money. And he said, these include some political figures, businessmen, a great many writers and journalists, government advisors, and finally, heads of press and television. Now, I submit that Andrei Sakharov is not an idiot. He knows whereof he speaks. As an academician, he had all doors open to him in Soviet society, the father of the H-bomb. I think that he knows what is going on. And it is strange, ladies and gentlemen, that of the great intellectuals, the people who have been able to perceive perhaps most clearly what is happening to the West are not the great intellectuals, the so-called great intellectuals of our own society, who have no restrictions on what they can read and what they can hear, but people like Sakharov and people like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Because it was, remember, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when he was still in the Soviet Union, before he was exiled, said that one of the great tragedies, one of the great shameful things in our Western history of Western journalism was that the massacres at Hue, where 3,000 corpses were exhumed after the one-month communist occupation of Hue, and another 2,000 civilians were missing and never found, that brings the total up to 5,000, that is some massacre. I mean, compared to My Lai, where you had perhaps 100, maybe make it 200 or 300, 5,000 at Hue. And what did Solzhenitsyn say? He said it did not get extensively reported in American press or television. Now, Solzhenitsyn knew that. And can you believe it? Eric Severide went on the air in his commentary on CBS, and he said Solzhenitsyn was wrong. He said it was extensively reported. And I wrote to Eric Severide, and I said, please tell me, Eric, when was it reported on CBS, ABC, or NBC? And he has never told me to this day. None of those pictures were ever shown. There are pictures of the corpses. They have never been printed, to my knowledge, in this country. Never shown on television. I did discover, I think from Big Story, that there was one report, how extensive it would, not inextensive, but of something about the Hue massacre, one time on one CBS program. The New York Times mentioned it maybe a dozen times over a two-year period. If you pick up the New York Times Index, big format, small print, and you look in the 1969 New York Times Index under My Lai, and the story of My Lai broke in the mid-November of 1969, so we're talking about a period of 6 weeks, and you will find 3.5 pages on My Lai in 6 weeks alone, and way over a 2-3 year period, maybe in all of the New York Times since 1969, you might find a dozen references to the Hue massacre of those 5,000 people that lost their lives. Not, let me emphasize, as some have said, Tom Wicker and others have said, not as a result of the people rising up. I think this is in the PBS documentary. They said this was the people rising up and taking revenge on their oppressors. This was the communist line. No, these were the communists, the North Vietnamese, going from door to door and collecting teachers, civic officials, leaders, others, taking them out, shooting them, clubbing them to death, in some cases burying them alive as a matter of deliberate policy. It's amazing But stories like that don't get told. They didn't get told. They didn't get emphasized. And again, it is the tragedy of this PBS series that the focus was not on the atrocities, not on the brutality, not on the cruelty of the enemy. It was on the cruelty, the brutality of the Americans and the South Vietnamese. You know, on April 13th, 1975, 4 days before those communist Khmer Rouge troops moved into Phnom Penh, Cambodia, the New York Times carried a story by Sidney Shanberg, Dateline, Phnom Penh, Cambodia, and the headline said, "Indochina Without Americans. For most, a better life." Sidney Shanberg is now an editor of the New York Times. He has a comfortable life. It was a better life for him. He went on to greater things. But the people he left behind suffered and died. And perhaps until some of the journalists, some of the Western journalists, have to experience the fate of their victims, they will go on predicting a better life for the people who are doomed to live under communism. That is something we have to change. It's a big job, but let's get busy and do it. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thanks for coming.